Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gawaza, and for today, we are looking at, something that's just a little bit different. We've spent a little bit of time talking about some of the impacts of the COVID-19, and one of the things we still haven't really touched on, which seems to have now become a thing, is some of the more opportunistic elements in our society that may take advantage of this time of crisis for ill-gotten gain. And one of the things that's actually happening is that a spate of government investigations into COVID-19 relief applications in South Africa actually mirrors a similar trend in governments around the world as they seek to actually mitigate increasing instances of relief scheme fraud. And to help us to sort of unpack what's going on in the space, we are joined by Daryl Bernstein, who is a partner and head of dispute resolution at Baker McKenzie Johannesburg, together with Johan Boots, who is a partner and head of employment and compensation at the same law firm that is Baker McKenzie. Gentlemen, greetings to you. I think I'll just start on the side with Johan, just talking about how people are actually going about doing some of these things, and how is this something that affects more businesses, or is it something that's affecting more the state in terms of some of these schemes that are going on out there?
Mudiwa, thanks. What we have seen, certainly with the COVID-19 claims, South Africa is not unique in this situation. We've seen it reports from around the globe, speaking to colleagues in other jurisdictions, that there's a spate of criminals who are targeting these relief schemes and submitting fraudulent claims and then benefiting from it. So the victim in this instance is generally government, who is funding these relief schemes. And we're seeing the same on that. There were reports in the newspapers last week of 5 people being arrested, in relation to making fraudulent UIF claims under the government schemes. So we as taxpayers, are all that poorer for it, because these criminal elements are tapping into these relief schemes under circumstances when they either should not be entitled to it, they submit fraudulent claim, and there's a number of examples that I can give you of, the sort of things that criminal elements are doing out there in order to benefit from these schemes.
I guess on that, I'll just bring in Daryl to sort of understand then, are there any measures in place? Because, one of the things around these relief schemes, I can imagine that one of the things they are taking advantage of is just how confusing some of the messaging has been, and the fact that even the people that should be legally allowed to get some of these relief benefits actually don't even know how to, at least in the beginning, there was a big information overload, people not knowing what's going on. So can you give us just some insights into what safeguards the government actually has in place to make sure that the right people actually get these benefits?
Thanks for that, Madhuwa. I think that's a really important point. The complexity associated with making these claims is in some respects a large disincentive for people who would otherwise be entitled to claim, as you say, not knowing how to claim. And then, of course, difficulties with being able to follow through on the claims, government issues with their ability to make payments in respect of the claims, and the fact that the claims processes close and become no longer available at a certain point. So I think in some respects, the complexity of the process acts as a rather unfortunate blocker for people to get into the system. But there is a process, there is a system, there is a requirement to capture one's details properly and appropriately in order to ensure that one makes a proper claim. But the government is very reliant, I would suppose, on people acting honestly and appropriately and doing the right thing in the manner in which they log their claims. And there are serious ramifications. So in addition to the complexity, government is dependent on parties acting in the appropriate manner, openly, transparently, and honestly in the way that they capture their claims. And they give their details to the government. They put their details into the systems appropriately when they make their applications. And there are serious ramifications for failing to do that. Criminal offenses, obviously, for fraud and civil penalties for failing to follow the appropriate steps.
I guess at the moment, the big question then becomes, because we've already mentioned the fact that perhaps the big loser here is the government that's actually funding the relief benefits. But I'm not sure, which of you can answer this, but has there been any calculations into what the quantum of this risk could be for the state?
Well, what we can certainly see, the five people who were arrested last week, they were involved in fraud of 5.7 million. So, in June, the government has already provided 23 billion in COVID relief to over 4.7 million workers. So if we were to say, just as a portion of that, what the type of relief could be, it could be billions of rand that could be siphoned off from the state coffers into the hands of criminals. I suppose it's probably difficult to give a sense of what we could be in for. But, just looking at five people arrested, that was for an amount of over 5.7 million. If we were to extrapolate that as a portion of the 23 billion relief that's been provided already, I would be surprised if the eventual figure is not in the billions.
Johan, just as a follow-up to that, are we sort of, perhaps not to be too pessimistic, but given everything that's wrong in the world, given the all the corruption allegations in a country like South Africa, and the fact that you're saying this is something that's not unique to South Africa, should governments perhaps not have, not should they not have, but is this not something that they probably built into their system, sort of expecting that someone is going to try and take advantage of this?
I hear you, Mdiwa, but I've got great sympathy for government because, and again, this is not unique. We've seen this, and there's been similar pleas from the Her Majesty's government in the UK, in a recent report. Government was essentially building this plane as they were flying it. As the crisis hit us, the intention was to get relief funding into the hands of those people who need it as soon as possible. And in the process, as practitioners, certainly it was very difficult for us as employers. It was immensely difficult because of the complexity of the scheme. But that complexity was aimed in a large degree to try and avoid the fraudulent submission and use of the schemes. So, with hindsight, we can develop virtually foolproof systems or better systems that will avoid more fraudulent activity. But the intention of government at the time was to make sure that let's get relief to those people who desperately need it. And there are still a lot of people who are in desperate need of this money. So I think if you're going to err on the side of getting the relief out. But then that's where we are at the moment. Now that as we work through the system, I have no doubt whatsoever that government is going to start like they're doing in other jurisdictions and say, we have dispensed this money in good faith based on the submissions that you as employers have made. Now we're going to have a look and see whether what you said to us is indeed true and accurate and correct. And I think that is fair and proper from government to do that. And I think businesses should be well aware of this. This next wave of action that's going to come, where government's going to say, considering all this taxpayers' money that we expended from public coffers, during COVID-19, let's make sure that what we dispensed was in line with our intention and recoup from those unscrupulous elements, those unscrupulous businesses, what we can to put back into the state coffers. Because all of this funding, all of this emergency aid has to be funded at some stage or another. And if I was in government, I would have said, let's try and make sure that we can get back from those people who shouldn't have benefited from this.
Daryl, on your end, can you sort of take us through, the steps? I am, the head of an organized crime syndicate, and I've got my 10 fellows, and we're saying we want to make, using the numbers, that we're extrapolating here from the example of the five people arrested. You know, we're all sitting there saying our goal is to reach 1 million rand each. How are people actually going about, you know, defrauding the state? And is there one, you know, sort of trick that's being used, or are people, you know, sort of, have they diversified their criminal activity?
I think we've seen a few different approaches to the way in which criminal activity can take place here. Interestingly, almost 500,000 valid applications put in, as far as the government is concerned, put into this funding, right? Which means there are a significant number of applications which were already deemed by the government to be invalid. And the simplest possible approach by a criminal who's looking to defraud the UIF or any other pot of funding available is to simply fabricate the existence of a business, to fabricate payslips, employee records, the existence of a labor force entirely, and to put a fake paper trail in place to defraud the government. That perhaps is a significant amount of work for a prospective criminal who's looking to defraud defraud the coffers of government. And there are other more sophisticated and possibly easier techniques that we've seen, particularly in the cybercrime space, which are being adopted by criminals to sort of profit from these kinds of examples. Perhaps the most common and the most sophisticated form of cybercrime we're seeing at the moment is what we would call the authorized push payment fraud, Madiwa, which is really quite a sophisticated long game that a cyber criminal would conduct in relation to a potential target, where they would hack their emails and then would then spend time within someone's email account without alerting them to the fact that the emails have been hacked. So they have access to your emails, they would review them, they would read them, and they'd really come to grips with you as an individual, perhaps with the business for whom you work, if you're an employee, if you're a business owner, and they would come to understand how you conduct yourself, how you write your emails, what your day-to-day activity looks like. And then they would carefully construct a narrative, depending on the particular type of fraud or crime they seek to perpetrate, and they would then email either the UIF, the employer relief scheme, to make an application on your behalf with their bank details, but using the language and the approach that you would have taken in your business. And they can create a significant amount of harm and havoc when they do this. They can reach out to your investment fund managers, we've seen taking place. We have cases on that basis. They can reach out to your bankers. And with the appropriate background information and language, they can convince a variety of stakeholders with whom you do business to make payments that ought to be made to you, to them, and into their bank account. And they go so far as to delete your sent items, which they have then sent, so that you would never be able to trace the time that they spent in your account, and you may never know that your email accounts have been hacked.
That is actually quite scary, this example that you are sharing with us, especially the time and the energy to actually study you know, the activity of someone, maybe even come up with how they write in their style. Johan, it definitely sounds like a massive amount of, I think, cybersecurity experts call it social engineering. How can companies, you know, perhaps either safeguard or, you know, perhaps protect themselves, especially after the fact?
Sure. So if I was a business owner and I made a submission, or my company made a submission for a TERS or UIF funding during this period, what I would do, as without a shadow of a doubt, is to appoint somebody, get a team involved, make somebody responsible for doing an internal audit on all the claims that we have submitted as an organization, make sure that we are comfortable that we submitted only for active employees. One of the ways our criminals or non-scrupulous companies are defrauding the system is by having ghost employees, people who are not on their payroll, on whose behalf they are submitting claims. We've seen examples of people inflating salaries, so saying that my employee is earning more than what they actually do in order to try and make good the difference, you know, in payment that they would lose, that they have lost during this process. So I would appoint somebody and say, do an internal audit for me on all the claims we submitted and make sure that we can justify every single thing that we've submitted, that all the information is accurate and correct, and furthermore, that all the money that we've received back from the TERS scheme, you know, has been dispensed to the employees, that we haven't kept any of that money inadvertently for ourselves as an organization, which would be against the law, because I would like to know that information before the Department of Labor comes knocking on my door. So that if there are issues that we need to resolve, if there is disclosure that we would need to make, where we need to go back to government and say, listen, we have submitted X for you, but having considered now and having done an internal audit, it would appear that we made a mistake in respect of this aspect or that element, that you can proactively remedy that. You know, I would not want to go and spend some time in a state facility just because my HR manager or the person responsible for the claim, you know, made serious mistakes, and, you know, we did not pick it up until such time as there was an investigation by the Department of Labor. And those investigations, I have no doubt, are going to come.
Daryl, in terms of, you know, everything that's going on, one of the things that's come out of the conversation is the fact that the government has largely been sort of making this stuff up as they go, you know, just as many other governments have, you know, have done. Are there any provisions, you know, in you know, current legislation about about where the buck stops with some of these things? We mentioned at the start that ultimately the big loser is government because they are funding. But in terms of responsibility, if, you know, someone is able to work through and social engineer claim through an organization, for example, using that type of example, who's actually responsible at the end of the day? Is it the company, you know, that, you know, ends up filing a fraudulent claim because someone has infiltrated their organization? Or is it the government that actually has to check each and every application that comes to them?
It's a very difficult question to answer. It's, you know, in the example of the authorized push payment fraud, it's very difficult to place liability at the feet of the company that itself has been a victim of the fraud. The underlying criminal perpetrator, who is largely anonymous, possibly not even based in South Africa. A lot of these cybercrime networks are run from outside of South Africa and from various parts of the world. It can be very difficult to trace who is ultimately responsible for the conduct here, which is why Johan's earlier suggestion about properly auditing one's claims is very, very important, so that if you are not responsible for a claim that's been submitted, you cannot be held responsible for that fraud as an organization. Ultimately, if you do make an error or overreach in relation to the claim that you submit, very important to correct your having done so. Because the buck will stop with you if that is the case. And what does that mean? What are the sanctions? What are the punishments? Where do you end up on this? I think, you know, the criminal and the financial penalties, the repayments that one would have to make, I think that's the tip of the iceberg, frankly. What we've seen in various parts of the world is that the reputational damage that can flow from overreach in these kinds of claims is quite significant and can be very damaging for a business. What we've seen is it goes as far as businesses that are entitled to make these claims but are incredibly profitable and lucrative as a general proposition and probably don't need the funding as badly as others that are affected by the crisis have taken a huge amount of reputational damage and have really come under fire for almost indulging in their ability to draw on claims, which they are perfectly legally entitled to, but perhaps don't need quite as badly as others. And we've seen that have some major blowback for organizations around the world.
I'm going to end off on this particular point. I'd like to just get both your takes just around, because you guys are looking at this space constantly. And, you know, when one, you know, considers some of the new legislation like Poppy, which came into effect at the start of this month, it sounds like this is exactly the type of thing that it is, you know, geared to protect against. But from, you know, both your vantage points, looking at things around the world, What are some of the other trends going on around the world that you haven't necessarily seen here yet, but that may potentially come to our shores? Daryl, I'll start with you and then Johan.
Yeah, but the point that I've just ended on, I think, is probably something we might see in South Africa. I'm a big fan of the English Premier League. I follow English football, and the team that I support, Liverpool Football Club, league champions for the year, very exciting. They in particular, they had to do a complete U-turn on their attempt to claim from the UK government for employment funding. And in their case, they had the ability to furlough staff and ensure that their staff were fully paid as a result of the available funding. And the government funding in respect of that, their staff members was only a small proportion of their salaries. And the football club was going to make up the balance. But even that approach of furloughing their staff and taking government funding to ensure that those staff were fully paid had a huge backlash for the club. And they had to do an about turn and they had to ultimately say that they weren't going to take any of that funding because it would be inappropriate to dip into government coffers to do so. So I think organizations in South Africa that have benefited from relief in circumstances where the general public may not agree that they ought to have benefited from that relief may be something that causes significant reputational.
Johan?
Yeah, I would say that the trend that we are seeing is that world-class organizations are trying to get ahead of the curve. They're trying to anticipate, you know, what's going to happen as far as action from government is concerned. They want to get themselves on the right side of public opinion on the issue. And I think that's probably the best, you know, looking around the corner type of advice that we can give to local businesses as well. Is make sure that your house is in order. Don't leave this to chance. And when the knock is going to come on the door from the Department of Labor, you're not going to have the luxury of time to remedy things then. Now's an opportunity. Before you make further claims, make sure that you've got the right people appointed within the organization that are accountable and that can verify the information that is sent through. But without a doubt, you know, if it was my business, I would want to make sure that that I can justify and happily have my name in the newspaper as to the claims that we've submitted during this period.
So that's been it with the team from Baker McKenzie Johannesburg. That was Daryl Bernstein, who is the partner for and head of dispute resolution, together with Johan Boutis, who is a partner and head of employment and compensation at Baker McKenzie. Both of them just giving us a roundup of what the scam landscape is looking like in terms of COVID-19 relief. That's coming from the government, and the fact that there are fraudulent claims that are being made on behalf of fake companies, on behalf of, you know, in some cases people actually infiltrating companies and being able to gain from some of the social engineering people are able to do. Daryl, just ending off talking on about the reputational damage that could be caused to a company, and then, you know, Johan just saying that before any further claims are made, just make sure that you have your house in order, you know what's going on, you have the right people appointed, and you actually have an audit of all the claims that are being made from inside your organization. Ultimately, it's a complex situation of where the buck stops and who's to blame and who's not to blame. But at the end of the day, in some cases, the fact that money is going to people that don't deserve it means that it is ultimately taking food away from those that do.
This is Mudiwa's Take.
It's quite an alarming problem that's being highlighted by Johan and Daryl just around what's going on with the fraudulent claims. And I think more than anything else, it just shows the opportunistic nature of people all the time, because even in the middle of a crisis, especially a crisis of this magnitude, you'd think that there's this global solidarity around the fight against COVID-19 and stuff like that. But, you know, in the midst of it all, it sort of seems like some people have taken an attitude that COVID-19 is just one other thing in life that's potentially going to kill a person, and that they're just going to continue with business as usual. And if you run a criminal enterprise, if you're a criminal, or if you're someone who thinks that they'll be able to nefariously, you know, get some money out of the government, then, you know, it's just one of those things just around questionable morals. But more than anything else, we can have a debate about questionable morals. But the important thing is just making sure that, as individuals and businesses, people actually safeguard themselves, just so that they aren't caught, on the wrong side. You know, at the end of the day, when you defraud the government, it's different from, the consequences are different, and, you know, depending on where you're sitting, you know, in the equation. Rather, if you're a business owner, just make sure that everything is in order on your end, just so that you aren't caught out. Have the necessary systems in place, because there is some scary data coming out from certain companies, such as Accenture, which has said that South Africa is the country with the third highest number of sort of cybersecurity victims in the world, resulting in, you know, over 2 billion rand being, you know, lost to things like fraud. So this thing is actually, you know, quite deep. At the same time, you have companies like Mimecast talking about how email fraud is still a very big risk for organizations in South Africa. And when you take those two pieces of data and you sort of overlay it on the conversation and some of the things that Johan and Darryl are talking about, particularly the social engineering bit where people infiltrate an organization through hacking emails and being able to then, you know, start making, you know, formal sounding or looking requests from, you know, that sort of thing. The fund manager's example was a particularly scary one, because that's now moving away from the realm of just government benefits and actually into real money. And the fund managers, you know, are managing money on behalf of other people, you know, so, you know, perhaps pensioners or people that have saved their money. So the implications of these things are quite large when you think about them in that context, and beyond just some of these COVID-19 relief benefits that we're talking about. So very important problem, and we hope that the country and businesses alike are going to be doing what's necessary to protect themselves going forward. So that's been it in terms of this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab. On Twitter, we're #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.